Okay, we're going to go to France now and to John Litchfield in Paris. Good evening, John.
Hello, Colin.
I suppose France is one of the places that has given people a precursor to a lot of the divides that are going on elsewhere in Europe. You've got a Eurosceptic party that has maybe moved to a Eurocritical stance now, at least in how they're selling themselves, and a pro-European party. France has done this all before. But before we get into the nature of the debate, how many MEPs can France elect and how do they elect them?
Well, there are 81 seats for France this time, which is up from last time because of the British seats being redistributed. I think there were 74 in the last parliament from France, 81 this time. And basically, the French are used to having two round elections, as you know, but in the European system, they're only allowed one round, which causes some confusion to some people. But essentially, it's a sort of national constituency of 81 seats, and people can run lists of 81 candidates, and proportionally to how many votes they get seats. So if you win enough votes to get 10 seats, the first 10 candidates on your list go to the European Parliament. Believe it or not, there are 34 lists running in France, 17 of which have enough support, sometimes only just enough, to show up in the opinion polls, and 17 don't show up at all, including a royalist list, an Esperanto party list, and there are only 7 of the lists that are likely to win any seats at all.
All right, the royalists, they live in hope.
Yep, that's right.
So, in a lot of countries, European Parliament elections are second order elections, and it's a chance to have a dig at the incumbents when voting day comes along. From the outside looking in, Emmanuel Macron talks a lot about the future of Europe. So, are the French more engaged in the European consequences of this election, or are they just the same as everyone else?
Absolutely the same as everywhere else, much to Macron's chagrin, one could say, really, because essentially it has become, this election has become a referendum on Macron. His popularity after 7 years, or unpopularity after 7 years in power. It's become a midterm election of a classic kind. His unpopularity is difficult to explain outside France in some ways, but it's partly connected to the big pension reform last year, which was opposed by so many people, sense that he hasn't really delivered the revolution that he promised, inflation, crime, immigration, all those things. So essentially, there is someone on National, the far-right party, Marine Le Pen's party, led by her number two, Jordan Bordella, is kind of way ahead in the polls. I mean, they're at 32%, which is 15 points ahead of Macron's centrist alliance, Renew, which is, its list is led by a relatively unknown woman called Valérie Hayer, who is the chief Macronist Euro MP at the moment, but has turned out not to be a very charismatic campaigner, tends to speak in sort of Brussels officialese, whereas the Jordan Bardella, the number two in the Rassemblement National, who's the leader of their list, is, only 28. It's been a bit of a phenomenon, really. He's become extremely popular in France, has slightly brutal boys band good looks, but he's a very fluent speaker, easily stumped if challenged on any of the facts he produces, but has become very popular as a kind of blunt-spoken, ordinary man compared to the sort of gobbledygook-speaking politicians as French people often see them.
And Marine Le Pen's party, Rassemblement National, they have at least softened their image in terms of, they don't want to leave the euro anymore. They don't want to exit the European Union. How much substance is there to the change? And, if there is substance to it, does that explain how well they're doing in the polls?
No, not really. I mean, I suppose it does, in a sense, it diffuses that argument that they're a party that would take France out of the European Union, which wouldn't be popular in France. But essentially, although they've abandoned those as policies, they remain extraordinarily Eurosceptic. Essentially, their policy is to sort of destroy the EU from within, to ignore the single market, to have preference for French goods, not to necessarily pay all their dues to Brussels. So, but people haven't really focused focused on that. And that's one of the things that's frustrated the Macron camp, I think, that essentially the whole of this European election has not been on these rather incoherent European policies of the candidate that's leading, but it's been on national issues and on the popularity of the president. One of the things Macron's done, Gamble, really has challenged Marine Le Pen to a debate, which hasn't been agreed yet, but is likely to be agreed week after next, which has never happened before in a European election in France for the president to sort of get involved in that way. And he obviously hopes he can repeat his pretty he slammed Marine Le Pen on two occasions and two last presidential elections, and he obviously hopes to do that again. But it's a bit of a gamble, you know, because it's putting himself in the ring makes it even more clearly a referendum on him, and he may not find it so easy to demolish her in the debate this time.
You wrote, I think, back in March that Vladimir Putin looms large over this election. He may be the winner.
Well, I mean, the Macron camp has been doing all sorts of things, none of them successful, to try and distract from the Rassemblement National's choice of this campaign as essentially as a national campaign and a referendum on Macron. Essentially, started off by connecting Marine Le Pen, as she was, very clearly to Putin for many years, and reminding people of that and suggesting that this was their referendum on the future of Europe and on support for Putin or not. That didn't get them anywhere. And then Macron made a big speech about the future of Europe, and which was partly aimed at these elections, suggesting that these elections could decide whether the EU survived or not. That hasn't made much effect either. The electorate, insofar as it's focused at all, and only about 50% of voters say they're going to vote, doesn't seem interested in the European issues at all, despite there being quite genuine big European issues, as you've been hearing. It doesn't seem to have really got through to the electorate. But one thing that has happened, though, also, which has damaged Macron's camp, is that the centre-left, under centre-left MP Raphael Glucksmann, has been doing very well. And since Macron came along and took the centre ground for himself, the centre-left had practically disappeared from French politics, but he's kind of rebuilt it, partly through centre-left voters who are disappointed with Macron, think he's gone too far right. And he's offering a very strongly pro-European campaign, which has gone down pretty well.
Finally, then, just on Macron, he allowed recently for the possibility of boots on the ground in Ukraine. I mean, whatever about being pro-European, was that a step too far for some French people, for a lot of French people indeed?
You know, I don't think that has damaged his popularity. His popularity is mostly about domestic, or unpopularity is mostly about domestic issues. I think that did sort of jar a lot of French people. But I don't think that explains why he's doing so poorly in the polls. He might have thought it would help him in the polls, but it hasn't. But I don't think it explains why he was doing so badly in the first place, or is doing so badly since. I think that it was, I mean, it'd been difficult to try and get to the bottom of that, but it does seem to have been a sincere shift in Macron's position away from his attempts in the early days, as you remember, to negotiate with Putin and to suggest that whatever happened, Russia shouldn't be humiliated in the outcome. He's now come around to the view that Russia is an existential threat to not just to Europe, but to democracy, and therefore there has to be a defeat for Russia in this war. And if the Ukrainian look as if they're going to lose the war, then at some point it may be necessary for NATO countries to not just supply weapons, but supply troops.
All right. John Litchfield, The Independent's John Litchfield, thanks very much for joining us on the line. Karen, going back, I suppose we've looked at the scenario in Italy and the impact on the European Parliament and its makeup should Giorgia Meloni's party do well. Where does Marine Le Pen sit, and what would the effect be in the Parliament?
Well, Marine Le Pen's party is part the France's National Rally Party. Her party, Colm, is part of the Identity and Democracy group. Now, this would be considered the far right part of the axis in the European Parliament. So the European Conservatives and Reformists, their right, hard right, the identity and democracy very much to the far right. They have, for example, not just Le Pen's National Rally MEPs, but and they have about 18 of them. They have the Alternative for Germany party also in there, and they're considered to be, again, highly Eurosceptical. Some issues with even an existing MEP of theirs and their links to Russia. They've the likes as well of the Danish People's Party in smaller numbers. But they would be at the very far right of the political spectrum. So even if they return more MEPs, the question is, can they get together as a group and form a cohesion view on different things? And can they then in turn work with their nearest right-wing allies, which would be those in the European Conservative and Reformist group, and also come together to shape their views and to either reject or accept laws? And that's a very big, there's a lot of doubt about that, because the reality is that a lot of these different parties and MEPs who are part of all these fringy far-right, hard-right political party groups, they don't agree on lots of things together. They fight with one another. They can have different views. So often it can be the case that even though, broadly speaking, they might be from a far-right, hard-right ideology, in many cases, they may not agree on different things. And I think Shona may have referred to this earlier. But for example, Poland's Justice and Law Party is in the ECR group, and they're extremely anti-Russia, while on the other hand, you have other parties in the Identity and Democracy group which hold different views on Russia and can be pro-Russia. So how those disparate groups will come together, that's hard to see. And that's why you may not get the kind of cohesion that you certainly would get in the more, in the bigger political groups like the EPP, right, like the Social and Democrats.
Shona, so in from Ursula von der Leyen's point of view, from the European People's Party point of view, apart from Ursula von der Leyen wanting to get elected, is there a certain pragmatism or playing of politics with the strategy of trying to peel the ECR away from the identity and democracy group and try and leave less room for them to cooperate and be a disruptive force?
That would be a byproduct. I don't know if that's necessarily her, what she's trying to achieve. What she's trying to achieve primarily is to get elected. And then after that, that would certainly help in terms of European policy, if you can divide those two groups. What she did say is she wouldn't work with any groups that are against Ukraine, against the EU and against NATO. And that would be the AFD, that would be, the Marine Le Pen's party and the various other groups who would like to see less militarism, because they buy in to the narrative that the reason for Russia's invasion of Ukraine is because of NATO and NATO growth and NATO expansion and so on. So she said she wouldn't work with them, and then that would help her, of course, move the ECR away. But then you see, those aren't the only issues at hand. I mean, you're talking about, we just came through a pandemic, for example. Those two groups were very much against any of the COVID restrictions, the COVID certificates, the vaccines, and that was obviously vital for keeping people alive throughout the pandemic. And we had the parliament that we did, which meant all of those things passed through. But if you were to veer and have much more influence from the far right, the hard right, the conspiracy theorists, then where would we have been when it came to joint procurement of vaccines, for example, if some of them were vaccine skeptics or some of them didn't want any restrictions, and then you'd have COVID flowing through Europe, and similarly with the council and the member states as well. So, and as I mentioned earlier, workers' rights and various other issues. So it's deeply problematic. But I think, as Karen said, the ID group are extreme. And as we'd heard, I think, from John Litchfield earlier, they are used to be Eurosceptic in a way that they want to split the European Union up, but now they want to destroy it from within. So they'll ignore things like the laws around the single market, and the EU is nothing if not a rule-based system.
All right, Shona, thanks very much for that. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this.
The Late Debate with Cullum O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.